When you first speak with Barbara Olshansky, she tells you that she will happily show up anywhere, anytime, for a chance to tell people what our government is doing in their name. She'll even show up in the produce section and talk to people over the cantaloupes. This is an endearing image, a woman so deeply concerned about her country that she'll do everything in her power to make sure that the citizens of that country have access to the truth. This image becomes deeply moving when you realize that Barbara Olshansky is one of the most important litigators in the United States today. Working out of offices, which I understand can only be described as modest, Barbara Olshansky and her fellow attorneys at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York have brought some of the most important lawsuits of our time. Lawsuits which are instrumental in peeling back the thick layer of secrecy this administration has put around issues of illegal detention and the treatment of prisoners. Her cases include Rasul versus Bush, a challenge to the detention without due process of detainees held at the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay, and a lawsuit seeking to hold United States officials responsible for the kidnapping and torture of a Canadian citizen. Barbara is the counsel for a number of people who find themselves in the most desperate straits that any person can find themselves in, up against the most powerful government in the world, in the history of the world, without access to a court of law, without the ability to see the evidence against them. Barbara and her fellow attorneys speak for these people who cannot make their own voices heard. Barbara Olshansky is the author of Secret Trials and Executions and a contributor to the anthology America's Disappeared, which estimates that on any given day, 20,000 men, women, and children languish in indefinite detention in the United States, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay, while thousands more are imprisoned in places whose names we do not know. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my privilege to introduce Barbara Olshansky.
I wanted to talk a little bit about our work and just what it's meant to me over time, and you know what I've learned. And I think the easiest way for me to start is to talk about what it was like for us. We're a really small not-for-profit. I'll swear you all to secrecy. There's only six lawyers. We use a lot of smoke and mirrors. But our work started immediately after September 11th. And it really started with people calling us at our office and telling us that people were disappearing from their homes. We work a lot with different immigrant rights groups, and people were calling those centers. They're calling from churches, from mosques, from all over the city, and eventually all over the eastern United States, and then across the United States, and telling us that their fathers, their brothers, their sons, their nephews, their husbands were disappearing. And it took us about 6 weeks to understand what was going on. We started looking for people literally in the local police precinct house, and then went from there to the regional INS office, to the regional FBI office. And it took us a long time to learn what a lot of people know now, that there was this initial roundup of people that were here on all kinds of visas, immigrants, foreign visitors, and foreign students. And what I think people still really aren't quite aware is that we sued early on for the information with a bunch of other civil rights groups, and Attorney General John Ashcroft immediately stated that the Freedom of Information Act, the federal statute that gives you access to all these documents, was no longer applicable in the war on terror. and that he refused to give us the information about who was detained, where, under what circumstances, what they were charged with, and whether their families knew and whether they had lawyers. And then when we sort of lucked out and happened upon one individual detainee when we were visiting somebody else, we realized that this was a pretty significant problem. We didn't really know the extent of it, and we filed a lawsuit. The lawsuit's called Turkman versus Ashcroft. And from talking to very few people, as soon as we entered an appearance on someone's behalf, they moved them to another facility across the country. So it took us a long time to figure out what's going on. We guessed at a lot, I'll admit it, in what we thought was going on in the complaint. And a year and a half after we filed it, a report by the Office of the Inspector General from the Department of Justice confirmed a lot about what we had guessed and what we had heard from a few individuals. And one of the things that struck me then, that seems to be this theme throughout, is that there was a direct instruction coming from the Attorney General to all the way down to the guards at the jail facilities, everywhere where people were being kept, to lie to us and to lie to the counsel's office from the various consulates that were calling for their citizens. And that directive actually meant that when you went to the door and when we asked for a detainee by the name of X and with their immigration number or any other information we had, we were told, no, they're not here, even though they were there. And that communications blackout, which is the euphemism that they were using, lasted quite a long time. And during that time, we have since learned people were very badly beaten. In fact, what we now know is these were folks that really overstayed a tourist visa, maybe did some work while they were here on a tourist visa, or didn't register for enough credit hours at their university when they were here on a student visa. And it took us a long time to unravel all of this because of the secrecy, this cloak of secrecy that was put over everything from the very beginning after 9/11. And that cloak has been overlaid over everything that this administration has done. And so when we start getting requests that are coming from overseas about people going to Guantanamo, we can't find out anything about it. And really the only way that we know we heard about it is through friends that we had at the International Committee of the Red Cross that don't really speak on the record because they may try to maintain their neutrality. And so what we then do, again, is have to guess at what's going on down there. We can't get near it. We can't get information. The government refuses to provide information. And we sort of have to guess. And on the basis of the few letters that are heavily redacted that people received, Shafiq Rasool and Asif Iqbal's families in Great Britain, Mozan Beg's father, Azmat Beg, David Hicks's father, Terry Hicks in Australia, we wrote a habeas petition, which is literally a case where you're challenging the legality of your detention. And we filed that in the District of Columbia District Court, and we filed it guessing the basis on which they're being held. We had no idea, guessing the circumstances under which they were arrested, and, not knowing anything about what was going on. And although we have some more information now, we're still in a lot of ways guessing, and it's more than 3 years that people have been held in Guantanamo. In January, it was 3 years. And we still don't know how many people are there. And when the Justice Department has been asked in court by a full panel of federal judges in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, lots of judges, 17 judges, asking the Department of Justice, how many people have been in Guantanamo? The answer was, well, we don't know. We haven't been keeping track. I think, you know, it's that arrogance and that willfulness to disregard the rule of law that we've seen like throughout this process, and that secrecy. And so we are continuing to litigate a case that, even though we won it in the Supreme Court, we won the right for them to go to court just to get their case heard. We are still unable to vindicate anybody's rights. We have gotten a few people to go down to Guantanamo and visit their clients, very few. We only have been able to get attorneys, enough people, the names of enough people, so that we have about 130 people are represented out of what we know are at least 550 there on any given day. And the government has refused to give us access to anyone else. What we've done to get these names is gone to Bahrain and Yemen and Morocco and Saudi Arabia and met with anyone that would talk to us in the government or outside, sat in cafes where people meet, gone out into the countryside to gathering places in the middle of the desert, and tried to talk to people to get names so that we can then file a habeas petition and try and get people their day in court. And we do know some statistics that have been released by the Department of Defense. We know that there are people from 45 countries there. We know that people were taken to Guantanamo as young as 9 years old and as old as 98. We know that there are still children there, despite the fact that the United States has said that there are not. We know that a great many of the people there are entirely innocent, and this comes from people within the Army, within Guantanamo. And we know that they're not applying the Geneva Conventions. And I have to be honest, you know, I was just a regular old civil rights lawyer before 9/11. You know, I did employment discrimination cases and I did education cases. I don't even think I really entirely knew what the Geneva Conventions were. But, you know, what they are is this floor for what maintains our humanity in a time of war. They are the very minimum that the world has decided upon to ensure that we are not brutal and barbaric when we wage war. You know, they were, you know, ratified and signed in 1949 in the wake of horrendous acts at the hands of many people in World War II. And so that's what these conventions are. And they're not, they do say, yes, you get the right to a hearing when you're arrested on the battlefield, and that's a very important right. You know, that separates the innocents and civilians from the people that were fighting. It might separate people that were terrorists who should be tried for crimes, from medics. But the Geneva Conventions also talk about being fed and being given water and medical treatment and interrogation and torture and cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment. And, you know, when we decided, the United States decided not to comply with the Geneva Conventions, when they made that decision that they were quaint, as Mark said before, they made a very calculated decision. And at the same time they were making that decision, another person that I'm sure Mark is also really familiar with, and I know from having read his work, another person also in that cluster of attorneys devising these plans was writing another memo on Guantanamo and why he thought that if the government put people in Guantanamo, they could really do whatever they wanted. Because, in his opinion, Guantanamo was beyond the reach of American courts, and there would be no judicial review of anything that happened there. And so these are the pieces of this secret puzzle they're selecting an island that they think no one is going to be able to peer into this prison. And they're dispensing with the protections of the Geneva Conventions. And they're redefining torture. And they're putting people away that many people first think, well, these are people that were in and around Afghanistan in the war. And what you quickly learn is that the people that were put there don't only come from Afghanistan and or Pakistan. And this is another piece that somehow never makes it to the press and is somehow part of this secrecy and is just really hopefully starting to come out. There are CIA operations that are still ongoing. And we know this because we have a whistleblower that's talking to us, that started talking to us this week. The snatch and grab operations, where they charter flights that go to countries around the world, where special forces jump out, hood somebody, shackle them, and bring them to various places around the world for interrogation under torture. Whether the CIA calls it extraordinary rendition, whether we call it kidnapping, some of those folks ended up in Guantanamo. And these are people that were literally taken out of their country, Algerians taken out of Bosnia, businessmen taken from the Gambia where they were starting a peanut oil manufacturing plant and taken to Guantanamo, people arrested in Zambia, in Belgium, in Spain, and taken to Guantanamo. And these are not people that were in military uniform. These are not people that had anything to do with the war. There was never any allegation. There's never been any criminal charges. You know, there are no criminal charges pending for any of these people. You know, and for a lot of them, there never have been in any of their home countries, almost all of them. And these people are being picked up all around the world. And when we're arguing the cases now, we're arguing because the government has said, well, the Supreme Court gave you the right to bring a habeas case for these people. They get the right of habeas corpus. They get that writ. They can file it. They don't get a lawyer. That was their first thing. Well, they can do it themselves, and we're going to give them pen and paper. And we won that battle. And then they said, okay, they can have a lawyer, but only one person gets to go down. And if you don't get a retainer agreement signed in the first day that you're there, then you're out, and they don't get a lawyer. And we kept fighting these battles. And we finally won all of them. And then they decided they were going to try and dismiss the case again and make us relitigate the case that we had just won in the Supreme Court. And that's where we are now. And one of the issues that a really brilliant judge in the court asked the government was, and this is Judge Joyce Hens Green, and she was dealing with all of the common issues in the 12 habeas cases that we managed to file early on. And she said to the government, let me understand, you think you have the right to pick up people, you call them enemy combatants, wherever they might be. And the government lawyer, Brian Boyle, says that's correct. And she says, okay, let me give you a hypothetical, like every good lawyer or law professor would say. And she says, maybe some of you read about this. There's a grandma, she's 78, she lives in Switzerland, she's dying. She decides she doesn't have anybody, she has no family, she's going to donate her money to an orphanage in Afghanistan. She donates it. She's failing, but she's still around. And it turns out that some of that money goes through one person's hands to another person's hands, and oh my God, ends up somewhere in some place that is related to Al Qaeda. And she turns to the government and she says, are you going to arrest her? And Brian Boyle for the Department of Justice says, yes. And she says, my Swiss grandma is an enemy combatant. And he says, yes. And at that point, I think
We all sat there, and even we were shocked. I mean, what do you say to that? You know, anybody, anywhere. And in fact, you know, it does sound laughable. No one laughed because everyone was so shocked. We didn't have any air in our lungs. But what's amazing is that this is who that administration is. And when I say this to people, they say, I don't believe you. I really don't believe you. And what I usually do is carry the transcript around with me so I can point to the Swiss grandma example. But the fact is that, you know, not only is this true, but in every court that we are arguing against the government, and we have a lot of these cases going on, they insist on this right no matter what the court says to them. And that is probably the scariest thing of all, is that this, the right to torture, the right to disappear people, the right to snatch and grab them out of their lives, is what this administration thinks it can do. And it can do with complete impunity. No one's going to say anything. No one's going to pay attention in this country. No one's going to care. These are Arab men. They're Muslim men. They're South Asian men. They're, you know, who cares about these people? They don't really have a voice. And they all look the same. And no one's going to pay attention. And that is really what these people believe. And it is an amazing thing to see and to argue against. And now we have what's been amazing for me in this is when we filed the Guantanamo case, the petition, it was way back in February of 2002, not too long after the attacks. And we didn't get too great a reception when we filed that case. That's really an understatement. And we lost very badly in the first round in the district court, and we lost even worse in the Court of Appeals. And I don't think anyone thought that we were going to get the Supreme Court to take the case and look at it. And what was a very interesting thing happened. When we were preparing for the court, we're preparing our brief before the court to argue why we should have the case and why they should take the case. People started calling us and being interested about it. And that was the first time that people weren't being interested and then using obscenities afterwards. And when the court decided to take the case, then there became a coalition of people that were supporting us in this fight. And this fight really only to get the bare minimum for these people under the Geneva Conventions. We weren't arguing for their release. We were arguing only for the bare applicability of the Geneva Conventions. And what was amazing to me, and which is still amazing to me today, is that the day that I picked up the phone and the person on the other end said, "Hello, Barbara, this is Norman Schwarzkopf." And I was like, "Yeah, right." And really, what came out of those telephone calls was an incredible coalition of people that had nothing to do with Republican or Democrat. There was an amazing array of retired Army generals, Navy admirals, officials from every segment of the armed forces. And there were former diplomats and former assistant secretaries of state and POWs. And they were all on our side. And I think they are, and for me, that was a surprise. You know, here I thought, I'm going to the Center for Constitutional Rights. I'm going to be this, like, really crunchy hippie lawyer. I'm so cool, even though I missed the 60s. And then what I find is, you know, my best friend in this battle is Major Dan Mori, a Marine major that's part of the Military Defense Council, who goes with us to Guantanamo and fights for the rights of people down there. And I think that's been a tremendous lesson for me. And it's one of the few things that keeps me going is knowing that the people that know about this stuff, the people that actually have fought our wars and fight our wars and know about foreign policy are the people that are horrified at this administration. And how we use them to change things, I'm not quite sure beyond the way that we already have. But it's clear to me that it's not everyone that is accepting of this administration's secrecy, of its want for torture. And I have faith, you know, an increasing faith and optimism. The more people I see that come to learn about it, and the more that I talk to all of those folks with the buzz cuts and the medals and that I thought I'd never be friends with. And the thing that is probably the most difficult and that remains difficult on a daily basis is that the court battles, I fear, are not really the place that we're going to win any of this. We already won in the Supreme Court, and we're not very far because it's an administration that doesn't care that the Supreme Court said you don't have the right to do this. That Justice O'Connor, a conservative justice, said to the Bush administration, you don't get a blank check on waging war, and it hasn't made a difference. And that, I think, means that it's up to all of us, really and truly, to go and talk to people in the supermarkets and everywhere else. Because what we're doing in the courts might be, you know, giving somebody a little bit of a poke in the eye in the Justice Department, but that's about it, really. They feel so emboldened that they continue with these operations in the face of many orders by many courts against it, and by the strong voices of military officials against it. And I guess that's, you know, that's my fear in all of this, is that if there isn't a bigger outcry by everybody that has a voice everywhere around this country, that that we will become that generation that sat by while people were tortured and killed in our name. And I don't want that to be my legacy. I can't bear to hear Azmat Beg say those words anymore. And there's so many people like them and like him. And I guess I didn't mean to be so grim, but I think that's how it came out tonight, despite the fact that I wrote 50 single-spaced pages that said something completely different. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to me, for listening to Azmat Beg, and for taking the time to think about this. And I know that everyone that's in here is already committed. And really, I want to thank you all for everything that you're already doing. It's nice to know that there are so many comrades in the struggle with me. Thank you.